Dr. Alton L. Wade earned his Bachelor of Science and Doctor of Education degrees from Brigham Young University and a master's degree from California State University at Long Beach. He joined the BYU community the fall semester of 1994 after serving as president of BYU Hawaii for 8 years. He was also president of Dixie College for 5 years. He served as president of the Church College of New Zealand and was the zone administrator for CES programs in the Pacific Islands, Asia, South America, and the Eastern United States. Throughout his life, he has been active in civic and church service and served in the Central States Mission. He has served as a branch president and stake president, as a member of the Utah Commission on Educational Excellence, and as president of the New Zealand Association of School Administrators. He is currently a member of the Polynesian Cultural Center Board of Directors. Vice President Wade will retire from Brigham Young University this spring after serving 8 years in Dixie and 31 years in the church educational system, as well as his time here at BYU. He has recently been called to serve as mission president for the Washington, D.C. South Mission. He is married to Diana Daniels Wade, and they are the parents of 8 children. I have enjoyed my personal association with Brother Wade over the past several years in the President's Council. Brother Wade is an energetic man of great integrity. He is a strong proponent of the aims of a BYU education, of the idea that BYU should not only sharpen the intellect, but also strengthen our spirituality, our moral character, our ability to and commitment to share our gifts with others. Brother Wade loves you, students, and is passionate about helping you become men and women of integrity and honor. I am pleased that we will have the opportunity to hear from him before he leaves the university. Brother Wade.
Thank you very much, President Wilkins. Most of you will have seen the picture now on the screen in the foyer of the church office building or in various church publications. It depicts Christ instructing his apostles on the outskirts of Jerusalem prior to his ascension. The last words uttered by Christ on earth before he went to his heavenly home were, "And ye shall be witnesses to me both in Jerusalem and Judea and in Samaria and into the uttermost parts of the earth." And Joseph Smith proclaimed, "This gospel of the kingdom shall be preached unto all the world for a witness unto all nations." In a 1974 regional representative seminar, President Kimball said, quote, "We have an obligation, a duty, a divine commission to preach the gospel in every nation and to every creature." What is significant about this phrase, uttermost parts of the earth? Had he already covered the area known by the apostles? Was it the people in Judea or those in Samaria or the few million in the Near East? Where were the uttermost parts of the earth? Or did he mean the millions in what is now America? Did he include the hundreds of thousands or even millions in Greece, Italy, around the Mediterranean, the inhabitants of Central Europe? Or what did he mean? Or did he mean all of the living people of all the world, of all the spirits assigned to this world to come in the centuries ahead? Have we underestimated his language or its meaning? End of quote. Today I would like to present 3 examples, all of which are personal testimonies to me of how the Lord prepares the way for the message of his restored gospel to be taken to the uttermost parts of the earth. In the early part of 1972, the principal of a small private school in the Gilbert Islands, now known as Keribas, sent a letter to the director of our church schools in Tonga requesting the opportunity for some of their elementary graduates to attend Liahona High School in Tonga. The letter was forwarded on to me in the church office building in Salt Lake City. After some quick research revealed that there were no members of our church in Keribas, I set the letter aside. Several months later, I received a large envelope containing approximately 30 personally handwritten letters from some of the students at the school, pleading for the opportunity to continue their education at Liahona High School. I was deeply touched by the sincerity of the contents of those letters and took the packet to the then Church Educational System Commissioner Neil A. Maxwell, who in turn discussed the letter and the matter with the CES Board of Trustees. The immediate question was, if we allow some of the Gilbert T. students to go to Tonga, and if while there they join the church and then later return to their home islands where there is no church organization, what will become of them? After careful consideration, the board decided to allow 12 students to go to Tonga on a trial basis. Brother George Puckett, the church educational system administrator in Tonga, was instructed to go to the islands and to select the students. While at Liahona that first year, all 12 were baptized into the church. As a result of that first year, authorization was given by the board to enroll 12 more, and most of them joined the church. It was soon became clear that the question raised by the brethren in the beginning was coming to pass. Some of the students were all ready to graduate and hopefully return to the islands. With this concern, Dr. Kenneth Beasley, then CES Associate Commissioner, who I'm very pleased is in the audience today, and I were instructed to go to Kedibus and to assess the situation. As we flew over the group of 16 islands, it seemed as though the airstrip occupied half the landmass of the central island of Tarawa. Upon landing, we exited the small prop plane, not knowing exactly what to expect or even where we were going because we had not announced our trip. All we had was the name of the school. We climbed into the back seat of an old World War II Jeep held together by wire and whatever else was available. I handed the driver the letter which identified the name of the school and asked him to take us there. After traveling a very short distance on a small coral road bordered by coconut trees and ocean on both sides, the driver suddenly stopped in front of several thatched huts. The huts had informed us that we had reached our destination. As we walked toward the huts, a young boy was standing nearby, and I asked him if the headmaster or principal was around, and he pointed the direction of one of the thatched huts. Looking inside, we saw a man sitting on a woven mat with his back toward us. As we entered, he suddenly turned and was surprised to see two strange Caucasian men. We quickly introduced ourselves and stated the purpose of our visit. He rushed over to both of us, gave us a big embrace, and began to weep. Because the plane only arrived and departed every 3 days, we spent our time getting acquainted with the principal, Waitea, the students, and the circumstances under which the school was being conducted. Two of the huts were classrooms with coral floors, nothing but mats to sit on, and no teaching tools or materials of any kind, except a few old hand-me-down textbooks and some paper and pencils. The other two huts were resident halls, one for the girls and one for the boys. Their beds were simple woven mats with a small wood log pillow. In the late afternoon, the girls went out looking for firewood and taro while the boys fished in the bay. They then returned, prepared their meals in an open oven. At the end of the 3 days, we paid our final visit to the school. The students assembled out in the open under the palm trees, dressed in white skirts, white shirts, and blue lava lavas. Both Brother Beasley and I gave a short speech and expressed our gratitude for their hospitality. Before presenting us with native handcrafts and gifts, the students sang some beautiful several songs in non-denominational songs and gave us a farewell. Believe me, it was an emotional experience, and my life was changed forever by being in the presence of these students and their teachers under the circumstances under which they were trying to gain an education. We returned to Salt Lake City and submitted our report to Commissioner Maxwell. The Church Missionary Committee then asked President Evie Davis of the Fiji Mission to look into the possibility of taking missionaries to the islands and establishing this church formally in Kiribati. President Davis visited the government officials and made the formal request. Much to his surprise, the governor granted his request, except, of course, there was to be one major condition. Any missionaries coming to Kiribati had to be Gilbertese citizens. The governor, prompted by the Catholic bishop, knew very well there were no Gilbertese members of the church, and that the approval given to President David Davis could not be put into effect. Of course, the governor didn't realize that the Lord was several years ahead of the situation. You can imagine what's coming. In April 1975, six of the first group of 12 students who enrolled at Liahona were graduated and had already served several months as missionary companions to Tongan elders. 3 months later, accompanied by their new mission president, Ken Palmer from New Zealand, the six traveled back to their homeland. They went to an ocean inlet on the main island of Tarawa, where during the World War II, the first American amphibious assault against a fortified atoll took place, and which marked one of the major turning points of the Battle of the Coral Sea in the Pacific War. It was in this war that our Marines attacked for the first time in the history of the war a coral atoll that had a coral reef out away from the island. And normally they had just gone up, hit the, and opened up the amphibious machines and gone out on the beach. In this case, they had to actually, about 150 yards, open up, had to go into water up to their waist, and with their guns up as high as they could hold it. They went in, and for 72 hours in the Battle of Tarawa, they were riddled and riddled until finally, after 72 hours with additional air power, they were able to take this island from the Japanese, and it was one of the turning points of the Coral Sea. Here in a memorial cemetery, President Palmer knelt with elders and dedicated the land of Kitibas for the preaching of the restored gospel of Jesus Christ. In March of 1976, President Palmer officially established the first branch of the church in Kitibas on Tarawa. It was determined that the continued existence of the school was desirable to meet the educational needs of the young people and parents who were joining the church in large numbers. The principal, Waitea, who had also joined the church, suggested that the church should take ownership of the school. That we resisted for a period of time, but it became clear that if our members were to receive an appropriate education and if the church were to continue to flourish, we would have to assume responsibility. During one of my several visits to Kitibas in the late 1976, Brother Paul Sorensen and I sat on a log next to one of the thatched huts and talked about the possible name of the school. During that discussion, it was suggested that it be temporarily at least called Moroni High School. In June of 1976, Grant and Patricia Hallett and their 8 children were called as special CES missionaries to direct the school. In September of 1978, Brother Richard Pratt and his wife Adeline were called as missionaries to Kitibas. Brother Pratt was a retired seminary teacher and also a master builder. He immediately started the process of replacing the thatched huts with brick classrooms and a chapel for use as school buildings during the week and church on Sunday. Tongan teachers from Liahona High School and CES missionaries from the mainland were brought to staff the school and to continue the construction process. In the meantime, the missionary work continued and several branches of the church were established on the outer islands. Today, Moroni High is the finest school in Kitibas, and the students are known as Moroni Warriors. It is staffed partially by former students who graduated, served missions, and went on to earn their degrees from BYU Hawaii, and are now back as teachers and administrators. On August 13, 1996, I received a letter from Waitea, the original principal, who said, and this was just a year ago, "Dear Alton Wade, it was a long time since you first came to Kitibas to give assistance to me for the plans and ideas of establishing the church school and the church itself as well. I'm very happy that the church in Kitibas at this time is not a branch, but a stake, and the school is rapidly improving. Now it is the most beautiful of all other church schools and even the government schools, and myself wish to give the greatest thanks to the church in Utah for its financial aid for all the school needs and the equipments at the first beginning. Now parents in Tarawa and other sister islands wish to send their sons and daughters to schooling in Moroni. I thank our Father in heaven for presenting me the long life to live so that I may see all the great and rapid changes. With many thanks, yours sincerely." On August 9, 1996, Elder L. Tom Perry of the Quorum of the Twelve dedicated Moroni High School, and on August 11, 1996, created the Tarawa Kediba Stake. February of this year, en route to Australia, President Hinckley made a stopover on the island and held a meeting for the saints and government officials. The pictures on the screen you are seeing were taken at the time of the President's visit. I repeat what President Kimball said in 1974. We have an obligation, a duty, a divine commission to preach the gospel into every nation and to every creature. If we could only make a small beginning in every nation, soon the converts among each kindred and tongue could step forth as lights to their own people, and the gospel would thus be preached in all nations before the coming of the Lord. Now, secondly, as some of you may know, the church operates a number of elementary and secondary schools in the Pacific Islands. One of these schools, located in Western Samoa, is called the Church College of Western Samoa. In 1975, during the time I was the church educational system's own administrator over that area, we found ourselves unable to fill two positions in the science department of the college with qualified Latter-day Saints. The positions were therefore advertised through the local paper, and to our surprise, two highly qualified Indian women appeared at the college office dressed in colorful saris. They were interviewed, hired, and started teaching the following week. As the school year progressed, their exposure to the church through day-to-day contact with students, faculty, and staff heightened their interest in knowing more about the Mormon faith. At this point of the story, it is important to understand how these two outstanding young women from India, one of the most densely populated countries in the world, happened to be in Samoa, one of the least densely populated countries in the world. In 1975, the Western Samoan government, working through the United Nations, requested the assistance of an internationally known tropical agricultural scholar to come to Samoa to assess their agricultural policies. Through an extensive international search, Dr. Henry Damaraj was identified, and he consented to spend 2 years consulting with the Samoan government. On this assignment, he was accompanied by Mrs. Damaraj and their two daughters, Lata and Asha. The Damarajes had arrived in Samoa just a few weeks prior to our advertisement for the science teachers. At the conclusion of each school day, Lata and Asha would go home to their apartment in Apia and share their parents not only the experience they were having in teaching at the college, but also their intense interest in what they were learning about the Mormon faith. It was not long until the family requested missionaries to come to their home and teach them in more depth about the doctrines of the church. In a few short weeks, all four members of the Damaraj family were baptized. Several months after their baptism, Brother and Sister Damaraj traveled back to India to celebrate the wedding of their daughter Lata. The following is a quote taken from their report of that visit. Quote, "A typical Indian marriage is a unique occasion for all families to meet. Having experienced several choice blessings since joining the church, we felt it was our duty to share the restored gospel with our families in India. We therefore took several copies of the Book of Mormon along with us. Lata's wedding took place in Hyderabad. The occasion provided us an opportunity to talk about the church to all of our family members that had assembled. We also distributed copies of the Book of Mormon. We found our family members taking an active interest in wanting to know more about the church." After their two-week visit to Hyderabad, the Damaraj family returned to Western Samoa and soon began receiving letters from India requesting more information about the church. The Damarajes wrote a letter to Brother Arthur Haycock, President Secretary to President Spencer W. Kimball, informing him about his families in India and their desire to know more about the church. Brother Haycock responded in a letter stating that President Kimball was aware of that request and that, quote, "the matter of the work in India is being very carefully considered," end of quote. During one of my frequent visits to Western Samoa, Dr. Damaraj informed me of his correspondence with the church leaders in Salt Lake City and indicated he was eagerly waiting word that a couple would be appointed by the First Presidency to go to India to work with members of his family. Several weeks later, and just prior to my again returning to Western Samoa, I was contacted by President Cannon of the International Mission and told that the first presidency had authorized him to extend a three-month mission call to Dr. and Mrs. Damaraj to return during their normal leave of absence and serve a three-month mission to their family in India. 2 weeks later, as I arrived back in Apia, I was met at the plane by a pale and extremely humble doctor and Sister Damaraj. He rushed over to me, embraced me, and whispered in my ear, "Brother Wade, you will never in all the world guess what is happening to us." Believe me, there were several moments of tears and emotion as we stood there on the airport tarmac. The Damarajas accepted the call and went on their three-month mission to their homeland. Following are excerpts from their March 31, 1979 report to the First Presidency, which Brother Damaraj shared with me and which I value greatly. Quote, we left Apia and we're now on our way to India. Suddenly we realized the magnitude of our responsibilities as missionaries and we were seized with fear. Anything wrong said or done by us would hurt the church and damage its future. We had several doubts. Were we capable of providing all the answers to the questions that would be asked of us by our family about the church? How many of them would agree to be baptized? As these anxieties bothered us and the plane was nearing India, Sister Damaraj opened her Doctrine and Covenants for comfort. And these were the words that came to her. "Lift up your heart and rejoice, for the hour of your mission is coming, and your tongue shall be loosed. And you will declare glad tidings of great joy unto this generation. Yea, I will open the hearts of the people, and they will receive you, and I will establish a church by your hand." End of quote. We read these verses again and again, and the words uplifted us and gave us courage as the hour of our mission was fast approaching. Whatever anxieties we had earlier slowly disappeared as we arrived in Hyderabad, India. My parents and our older brother David had already arrived earlier by train, so also my sister and brother-in-law Ramesh from Iran. All of the other families had already assembled at my brother's place. Without wasting any further time, we told all the members of our families that had assembled in my younger brother Henry's house the purpose of our visit. They were very happy that we had come, and therefore we talked on topics of great length. We spoke of God's kingdom in the latter days and the restoration of the gospel, and that the Book of Mormon is a new witness for Christ and it fulfills the Bible prophecies. We mentioned to them the restoration of the priesthood authority and the ordinances of baptism. We also discussed the Sabbath day, the law of tithing, and the word of wisdom. And finally, we stressed to them the need to study the gospel and strengthen their individual testimonies and enter into the waters of baptism. On the suggestion of one of our families, we fixed the baptismal service for December 27, 1978. My younger brother, Henry, placed at our disposal the water pool in the compound of his house for baptism. The pool was clean, painted, and fresh water let in. This was the day for which Sister Damaraj and myself were praying for and looking forward to. All of us were dressed in white, the ladies in saris and the men in loose-fitting Indian-style jackets and trousers. The first to be baptized were my parents. It was a thrilling moment for me when I stood in the water with my father and holding his hand, I said, "Samuel David, having been commissioned of Jesus Christ, I baptize you in the name of the Father and the Son and of the Holy Ghost." And the thrill continues that I held my mother's hand and my son's hand and those of my brothers and sisters and repeated these words. I baptized a total of 18 members of my family on this day. And immediately after the baptisms, I conducted the confirmation service the same evening. The next day, Sister Damaraj and I traveled about 6 hours by train and baptized 4 more persons of my family. These baptisms had to be done on the banks of a river, which is about 2 miles away from downtown. In all, I baptized 22 persons during the present visit to India. I also ordained 4 persons to the Aaronic priesthood. From Hyderabad, we went to see my wife's parents, who live approximately 16 hours away by train. Perhaps most of the church members are unaware that Sister Damaraj's father, a reverend in another church, is engaged since the last 14 months in the translation of the Book of Mormon into the local language of Hyderabad, a state called Telugu. This language is spoken by nearly 50 million people. The reverend is an ordained Baptist minister. While at his place, he showed us more than 500 full-scale, neatly handwritten sheets of the translation. Arrangements will be made for the church to print the translated version of the Book of Mormon in India as soon as it is ready and approved. At this moment in time, we just cannot visualize the impact this book will have on the more than 40 million people living in Hyderabad State. We consider this our greatest single humble contribution to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. At the time of Dharmaraj's mission, there were no known members of the church in the Hyderabad region of 40 million people. Even though proselyting is not permitted in India today, there are now approximately 3,500 members and 21 branches. The 700-page manuscript of the Book of Mormon, translated in Telugu by Sister Dharmaraj's father, was printed in 1982. I'd like to now to have two individuals step forward, brother and sister Richard and Lavanya Paul. Would you come right here for just a moment? If you could stand right here with a light. Today, we are honored to have in our audience two representatives of the fruits of brother and sister Dharmaraj's labors. Richard and Lavanya Paul. Lavanya's family joined the church shortly after it was established in Hyderabad in 1978. Richard is a recent convert, and they were married in 1998. Richard will be a graduate student at BYU this fall, and Lavanya travels to Salt Lake City several days a week, where she is involved in helping to translate the temple ordinances into Hindi. Thank you very much. The third example of the way the Lord is preparing the way for opening up the nations is one that started in 1955 and is being fulfilled even today. I suggest you would find few Old or New Testament prophecies that have unfolded in a more dramatic or timely way than this modern-day prophecy made in 1955 by President David O. McKay during the groundbreaking ceremony for the establishment of the Church College of Hawaii. I quote from his address, "We dedicate our actions in this service unto thee and unto thy glory and to the salvation of the children of men, that this college and the temple and the town of La'ie may become a missionary factor influencing not thousands, not tens of thousands, but millions of people who will come seeking to know what this town and its significance are. To understand the significance of that importance of that prophecy, we must study it in its time frame of 1955. First, the church could hardly be referred to as an international entity in 1955, as there were only 1,197 members in Mexico, 3,679 members in all of South America, 367 members in Central America, 392 along the whole Asian Rim, and a total of only 82,000 members of the church outside the United States, Mexico, and Canada. Second, while Hawaii was beginning to be recognized as an attractive tourist destination, only approximately 100,000 tourists came to Hawaii in 1955, and most of them were from the mainland U.S. Third, the north shore of Oahu was not considered a must-see part of the island of Oahu by either residents or tourists. The temple was just a get-out and stretch stop for the occasional Circle Line and tour. And fourth, the Polynesian Culture Center had not even been conceived of in 1955. This then was the setting when a stately white-haired prophet stood in the middle of a sugarcane field in the least visited part and the least interested part on the part of tourists of the island and prophesied that the college, the temple, and the community would be a missionary factor in influencing millions of people. I can imagine that even the most faithful follower and admirer of President David O. McKay must have wondered if he or she had heard the prophet correctly, and Satan himself must have had even a few chuckles over it. Millions of people coming to La'ie, you have got to be kidding. Nevertheless, the campus of what is now BYU Hawaii was built and opened its doors to 150 students, and 8 years later in 1963, with little pomp and ceremony, but with a great deal of laughter and predictions of its total failure from the Waikiki entertainment community, the Polynesian Center opened its doors. The PCC had a small and humble beginning, with students occasionally standing out on Kamehameha Highway, flagging down the occasional Circle Island tourist and inviting them to visit the PCC. There were even times during those first few years when the performers played to no more than 20 or 30 individuals. As a member of the board of directors of the Polynesian Cultural Center, I attended our mid-year meeting just 8 days ago in Hawaii and was there informed by the president that the attendance of PCC over the past 37 years has just exceeded 27 million guests from every corner of the world. Approximately one-third of those who have visited the Polynesian Culture Center have also visited the Temple Visitor Center just a few blocks away. Amazingly, Little IEA has become a destination for people worldwide, and the center has been the number one paid tourist attraction in Hawaii since the mid-1970s. Were he not a prophet, how could President McKay have possibly known in 1955 what we are experiencing today? However, there is another side of this story which may in times eclipse even the importance of the large number of people from around the world who attend the Polynesian Culture Center on a daily basis. When I was appointed president of BYU Hawaii in 1986, a cooperative Asian executive management internship program had just begun between PCC BYUH and several mainland Chinese government agencies. The internship arrangement allows for 8 to 10 mid-level government officials to spend 1 year studying at BYU Hawaii and interning at the Polynesian Culture Center. These individuals live on campus in resident halls with regular BYU Hawaii students. At the end of the year, they are given certificates of achievement in the various academic disciplines and professional activities at the Polynesian Cultural Center. Over the past 15 years, approximately 135 of these mature Chinese individuals have gone through this program and returned to their full-time employment in the government and business agencies from which they came. On two occasions since the inception of this program, Sister Wade and I were hosted by these agencies in China. During these visits, we met with the supervisors and employers to assess the program and recommend any changes or improvements which should be considered. Over a period of 2 weeks, we met with approximately 50 of the former interns in four major mainland cities in China. The reception we received from both the former interns, their supervisors, and the government officials was overwhelming. To those who had gone through the program, we were like long-lost friends, even family. They simply could not contain their emotions and wanted to spend most of our time together hearing about BYU Hawaii, PCC, La'ie, and all of the friends they had left behind. In every case, upon the completion of the internship and their return to China, they had been advanced to positions above those which they had previously held. During their time on campus, each individual registered for and completed a Book of Mormon course and in many cases attended the church on a regular basis. Some joined the church knowing full well when they returned to China there would be no LDS church unit with which they could be affiliated. However, they also understand in the Lord's due time, they will have an important and prominent role to play in spreading the message of the restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ, providing leadership and making friends for the church. Even those who do not embrace the gospel expressed over and over again to us their admiration for the church and the principles upon which it is founded. I am sure each one of them will be willing to speak in our defense if needed and appropriate. I'd now like to call three other individuals forward. If you would please come up here and stand right here while I introduce you. These three, and if you come right here where I think there's more light. These three individuals are currently involved in this program or at BYU Hawaii as a student. First of all, on my right over here, may I present Lei Chu. She will be graduating from BYU Hawaii in informational systems next year. But the main reason I wanted to have her here is because she is the daughter of one of the first executive management interns 15 years ago, and her father is a very significant government official in Xi'an. She recently just joined the church and came over to attend conference. In the center, we have Lena Lee. She is from Changchun, up in the northern province of China. She is a Changchun Communication and Public Affairs Manager. She is on this internship program that I've just spoken to you about and will be returning back to China. Lena is also a member of the church, and several weeks ago, and on a regular basis, goes over to Honolulu and does splits with the sisters in the missionary work. And on my left-hand side is Ektushin Toktoka. I practiced that all last night, but Ektushin is a lecturer, senior lecturer, and professor at Mongolian State University, Mongolian Foreign Language University, and has also a Mongolian National University of Arts. The interesting thing about Ektushin is that he is the recognized by the Mongolian state officials as the official head of the LDS Church in Mongolia. These are just three examples of what I've been saying of how these individuals are being placed by the Lord all over China, and the blessing that I have had over the period of years is working with them, and they are going to be very significant players in the due time when the Lord decides that China is prepared to be open. Thank you very much for coming. It is interesting to note the comparison of church membership stakes and missions from 1971 to 1998. I was in Korea in the mid-1970s when the first stake was established by President Hinckley. In 1971, there were 5,165 members, no stakes and no missions. In 1998, there were 69,000 members, 17 stakes and 4 missions. I was in the Philippines in the early 1970s when there were 9,700 members, no stakes and 1 mission. At the end of 1998, there were 389,000 members, 62 stakes and 13 missions. I was working in Chile and Brazil in the early 70s when the church was struggling for identity. These two countries combined had 55,000 members, 4 stakes, and 3 missions. As of 1998, these two countries had a combined membership of 1,120,000 with 300 stakes and 34 missions. I repeat again the last words by Christ on earth before he went to his heavenly home. And ye shall be witnesses unto me in both Jerusalem and Judea, and in Samaria, and into the uttermost parts of the earth. What I have described today is not unusual. Similar stories are taking place in other areas of the world on a daily basis. Some of you in this audience know of other such experiences. I bear you my solemn testimony, brothers and sisters, that all of us, individually and collectively, and that the whole world is in his hands, and that he is guiding and directing the work all over the world, even to the uttermost parts of the earth. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.